You're listening to Adventures in Jewish History with Rabbi Danny Sachstein.
Good afternoon and welcome to Adventures in Jewish History. Wonderful to be with you this Wednesday afternoon, this warm Wednesday afternoon here in Johannesburg. And one of the things I want to share with you is an important milestone that's just passed the last few days, which was on the 9th of November. It was the 80th anniversary of Kristallnacht. And Kristallnacht had with it tremendous implications, really was the beginning of the end for European Jewry. What's fascinating to see about the Second World War is usually there's a pattern. There's a pattern with regards to most evil behavior in the world. Most evil likes to cloak itself in some apparent righteousness. For example, we saw with Lenin and with Stalin, with Pol Pot, Chairman Mao. So they all claimed that although their actions were evil and what they did resulted in the death of millions of people, but they hid behind a cloak of righteousness, claiming that their ideas would bring a better plight, would improve the plight of humanity and bring a better situation for millions of people around the world. It definitely wasn't the case, but at least they hid behind that kind of a cloak. Even we see with the Muslim fundamentalists that they mask their evil behavior and their terrorism with a cloak of religion and faith. The exception to this rule was the Nazis. The Nazis were unadulterated evil. They were pure evil, and they didn't even hide behind a veil of righteousness or of morality. And it was clear to all of the world 80 years ago on the 9th of November, which was on Friday, that the Nazis were intent on carrying out their plans of the final solution and of wiping out the Jewish people. And one could just picture in one's mind's eye hordes of thugs descending upon hundreds of shuls across Germany. 267 synagogues were burnt to the ground. Thousands, hundreds of Jews were killed. 30,000 were sent to concentration camps. Thousands and thousands of Sifrei Torah and of Holy Sforim were burnt. 7,000 Jewish stores and businesses were destroyed and vandalized. And all of this was really the beginning of the end for the Jewish people and the beginning of the final solution. One of the great tragedies of Kristallnacht is that Martin Gilbert writes that of all the atrocities that the Nazis perpetrated during the Second World War, the one that was most publicized and most reported upon around the world was Kristallnacht. Every radio station, every newspaper covered these terrible atrocities. And therefore, the world saw very openly and obviously the evil of the Nazis and their intention. And the sad thing is that the world didn't do anything. The world left it. And it was just a few short months later that the Nazis plunged all of the world into the deluge of World War II, in which over 50 million people died. And we learn from that, we see from that, that when you leave evil, when you don't respond to evil, when you don't stand up to evil, it just puts the world in greater peril and results in greater hardship and suffering and destruction in the long run. I think it's a very clear parallel to what's going on with Iran today. The Iranian mullahs are set an intent of building nuclear weapons. And if they do so, we all know where they will be pointed immediately. At the land of Israel towards the Jewish people. And so to have policies of appeasement like the Obama administration and giving the Iranians money and signing a very weak agreement really puts not only the people of Israel but the entire world into great peril. And therefore the approach of the Trump administration is not to take the evil that they see in front of them, but to stand strong and to resist it with sanctions and with all other means possible is certainly the right approach, because we see the appeasement and the liberal policies of Chamberlain really put the world in much greater peril. And he is responsible for a greater suffering that could have been prevented if the evil was stood up to earlier. And I think there are many parallels in today's situation with Iran. Rabbi Beryl Wine writes that it's no coincidence that the first place the Nazis attacked and in the beginnings of the destruction of the Jewish people in Europe were the synagogues. And the first things that they burnt were the Torah scrolls. That's not by accident. But rather, the Nazi regime in Germany was basically anti-religion and anti-God. And that's what the Jewish people represent. They represented it back then, and we still represent that today. Jewish people represent faith and awe in the Creator, in a Creator of the world, in God. And even though at the time, at the times of the Second World War, in the late 1930s, so the vast majority of German Jewry had assimilated, and they were far more proud of their Germanness than they were of their Jewishness. But nonetheless, Hitler didn't distinguish. Hitler said that the problem with the Jews was a racial problem, was a genetic problem. He didn't distinguish between different Jews and their private personal practices. All Jews were seen as the enemy, because all Jews, whether we practice or not, represent this higher form of morality, represent striving to reach beyond our physical domination of one another and the strength and domination of autocrats in this world. The Jewish people represent a striving to connect to God, to bring a higher morality down into this world, and to fill this dark world with light and with beauty and with honesty and with straightness and with purity. That's who we represent. That's who we are, whether we practice or not, whether we like it or not. That is the nature and the mission of the Jewish people. And that's why Hitler writes very clearly in Mein Kampf, that's why the Jewish people were the enemy of the Nazis, because the Nazis represented the worldview of human domination, of human power, of the survival of the fittest, of the stronger one, might is right, which is the antithesis of the Jewish people. And so looking back, reflecting 80 years later on Kristallnacht, so we should let the fires of Kristallnacht drive our dedication to being what really Jewish means. That means to connecting to spirituality, to connecting to God, to connecting to the Torah, that the fires of Kristallnacht should drive within all of us a Jewish pride, a pride of being, of representing God's morality, of being ambassadors to God in the world, a pride of the state of Israel, a pride of what the Jewish people have done in the world and for all humanity, and a pride of representing the mission, the covenant of Abraham and our great ancestor Abraham, of whom we are descendants, that we carry on that covenant in the world, a covenant between human beings and the Creator of the universe. And even though b'chol dor v'adoy omdim aleinu l'chaloseinu, in every generation they stand up to destroy us, but nonetheless, we keep focused on our mission. We keep loyal to our commitment to God, and we are here to deliver and to be examples, to be models to the world of what it lives to, of what it's like to be a spiritual people, of what it's like to bring God into our daily lives and daily activities. And so, the fires of Kristallnacht should drive us all to be committed Jews, to be loyal Jews, to teach the message and the mission of the Jewish people to our children, and to ensure that we carry on the legacy and the covenant that our ancestor entered into with God over 3,000 years ago. So let's move on. That's the anniversary of Kristallnacht and the beginnings, unfortunately, of the end of the Jewish people in Europe and the Second World War. Let's look at a very interesting lesson that I would like to share with you that really is an extension of this, extension of what it means to be a covenantal people, what our focus and direction should be in this world. Sefer Bereishis is what we're reading right now, and Sefer Bereishis is called Sefer HaYashar, the Sefer of the Straight Ones, because Sefer Bereishis teaches us how to behave, how the great Avos and Imaos, the great patriarchs and matriarchs conducted themselves, the lives that they lived, and their model of human behavior, of bringing spirituality into this world, which we are all trying to fulfill. We know that Jacob leaves his parents' home, the home of Yitzchak and Rivka, his parents, and he is instructed by them to find a wife, to find a wife from the place where Rivka comes from. And he goes to that place, and he meets Rachel, and instantly there's a very deep connection, and they both sense that they're soulmates, and they understand that they are supposed to be together, and they together will build the future of the Jewish people. It was an amazing connection that they had, and a very fast realization on both of their parts about that. And Rachel's father, Lavan, is a very devious character. He's a dishonest person, he's a swindler, and he's a gangster. And he says it to Yaakov, okay, Yaakov, in order to marry my daughter, you need to work for me for 7 years. And Yaakov agrees with those conditions. And the Torah tells us, V'yavod Yaakov barachel shivashanim. And Yaakov worked for Rachel for 7 years. V'yu be'enav k'yamim achadim. Ba'avaso oisa. And they were in his eyes like yamim achadim, which means like single days, like a few days. Ba'avaso oisa, in his love for her, because of his love for her. So, it's interesting to understand. I would like to share with you two explanations of this. Why was it that those 7 years, because of Jacob's love for Rachel, that those years went quickly? They seemed like a few days. One of the explanations I read from Rabbi Twersky, who's a very famous psychiatrist, and he's been involved in the area of addiction for many, many decades, and has introduced many innovative and fantastic programs that have saved so many thousands from addiction. And Rabbi Twersky writes that he understood what this verse was saying from one of his patients. And this patient told him that he was dependent on alcohol. He was an alcoholic. And he thought that he could never again live life without the alcohol. And he could never get away from this addiction. When this individual joined Alcoholics Anonymous, he was told not to focus on the rest of his life, but to deal just with this day. It's not possible for you to sustain from drinking it's not impossible, they told him, for you to sustain from drinking just this day. You can do it, just this day. And then tomorrow, focus on that day and look at it one day at a time. And that's a important principle in life, because we see in the writings of the Balei Musar a similar principle. The Yetzer Hara, which is the evil inclination, the Yetzer Hara tells all of us, what's the point of even trying to observe the Torah and of the mitzvahs and to stay away from the prohibitions of the Torah? There's no way you can do that for the rest of your life. There's you're certain to violate certain prohibitions of the Torah. And in your quest to fulfill your desires, that's definitely going to happen. So why fight a losing battle? You may as well, why deny yourself even from the beginning if you're going to fail? You may as well just give in right now. And the response the Balei Musar say to the Yetzer Hara when it presents us with that argument is that I don't have to deal with the rest of my life today. I know that today I can withstand the temptation, and that's all that I am concerned about. When tomorrow comes, I'll deal with the challenge tomorrow. That should be our approach. That should be our response. And that's what the Torah is telling us, that Jacob, it says that they were like only a few days because he took it one day at a time. In fact, although the literal translation of that verse is that they seemed like a few days, the Hebrew word achadim really means single days. So the delay of 7 years would have been very difficult for Jacob to manage. So therefore, he didn't think of the 7 years. He took it day by day, each day as it comes. And that's a wonderful tool that we should all take, that when we're faced with challenges and with ordeals, and they seem to be very difficult, but perhaps today I can deal with them, but who knows what, tomorrow I won't be able to. So take it one day at a time and overcome that temptation today, and when tomorrow comes, we'll see what the situation is, whether you can do so. That certainly should be our attitude, and that's on the one hand the way Jacob seemed to deal with this challenge. But I want to look at it from a much deeper point of view and try and approach it with a beautiful understanding as to the real depth of what is going on over here. And this is based on what Rav Eliyahu Lopian writes in his famous sefer, Lev Eliyahu. I heard this from Rabbi Yosef Elephant from the Mir Yeshiva. Rav Eliyahu Lapion explains, and he says that the reason why the time flew for Yaakov, for Jacob, was because when we're involved in spiritual pursuits and those things that have substance and meaning, so our life is full and the time moves quickly. When on the other hand, we're looking to fulfill physical desires, when we're trying to fill up something empty, that's when time seems to take forever. So for example, let's say a person likes to have steak, enjoys steak, and they go to a restaurant and they order their steak and they're very hungry. And so they're waiting and waiting. It seems to be ages. You know, how long do they take to make a steak over here? They can't bear it to wait any longer. So that's when a person is longing for something physical. When, however, we're involved in something spiritual, so I'll give you an example. Perhaps we could say, for example, there's a wonderful program that Rabbi Ari Tabak brought to South Africa called the Dirshu program. Dirshu is a Daf Hayom BaHalacha program in which a single page of the Mishnah Berurah, the Mishnah Berurah is the Chofetz Chaim's commentary of the Shulchan Aruch, is learned every day. And thousands of people around the world learn that page every day. So it's just like Daf Hayomi in Gemara, in which many people are learning the same Daf in Gemara around the world. So this is a Daf Hayom BaHalacha program. And it's been very successful here in Johannesburg. My community, to the Sunny Road Kahila, it's been a very successful program. And each day we learn together after Shacharis at 7 o'clock in the morning. We learn one page of Mishnah Berurah. And Baruch Hashem, thank God, we've already learned today was our 943rd page that we learned today. And we already almost finished Chelek Gimel of the Mishnah Berurah, which is a really wonderful achievement. And everybody who's joined the program very much wants to finish the entire Mishnah Berurah, which is a great achievement and something every Jew should do, to learn basic halacha, to learn how it is that we're supposed to conduct ourselves in this world. But none of us in the program are feeling anxious and are feeling, you know, our nervous wrecks. When are we going to finish? When is it going to come? When are we going to get there? Because each day we feel like we're accomplishing something. Each day we're finishing a page and we are moving ahead and we are filled with the achievement that we are progressing and we're building up in a steady way. And therefore we're not left with this anxious feeling of when is it going to be. But when it comes to, in contrast, when it comes to filling a physical need, when there's a physical desire that we want to, that we're pursuing, that we're chasing. So we feel like we've got a void and we're empty and we need to fill up that emptiness. And therefore we can't wait. Therefore, you know, in the restaurant we'll be waiting for our steak, the clock hardly moves because we need to fill up that emptiness. It's a beautiful principle that Rav Yerucham of the Mir, the great Mashkiach of the Mir Yeshiva, says the following. He says, Lo midas ha-kodesh baruch hu k'midas bas v'dam, that the way that God operates the world is different to the way things operate in our physical world. Midas ha-kodesh baruch hu, the way things work in the spiritual world, kli male machzik, kli reik lo machzik, that a full vessel actually holds on and gets fuller in the spiritual world, but an empty vessel is not filled. Whereas midas bas v'dam in the physical world, kli male lo machzik, a full vessel cannot take any more. Kli reik machzik, but an empty vessel takes in more. So, for example, you've got a full glass. If you've got a full glass of Coca-Cola, you can't fill up, you can't put more in. It's already full. The glass needs to be empty full. But in the spiritual world, it's the opposite. In the spiritual world, when somebody's full, when there's substance there, so it continues, it builds, it grows more. And when nothing's there, where there's no substance at all, so it can't hold anything, so there's no further development of that substance. For example, we could maybe understand it. So we brought the example of eating a steak. You know, a person likes to have steak. So after three steaks, the person's pretty full, doesn't want to have any more. But if there was intrinsic value in that, so why not? You would want to have more. When it comes to spiritual pursuits, where there is, it's pure substance. Spirituality is pure value and content and substance. So then that's when a person can't continue to have more. We'll always want more. Because when we're accomplishing spiritually, so, and we actually feel like we are making progress in a substantial way, so then we will continue to pursue that. So that's what the Torah, on a much deeper level, the original explanation was take it one day at a time. The deeper level is, since Yaakov was involved in a spiritual endeavor, what's this spiritual endeavor? Because the pasuk tells us, the Torah says, "Ba'avaso isa," that he loved her. He loved her not because he wanted to fulfill a physical need, not because he was waiting for the steak to be ready and he was empty and needed to fill it up. Yaakov's waiting for Rachel was a very deep spiritual recognition that he loved her for who she was. So you might say, oh, you know, when in a couple, when one loves the other, they see the virtues and the great qualities of the other. And the reason why they love that person is because they know that that person is going to be a part of their life and they will benefit from those qualities. They will benefit from that person. But that's not true love. True love is an altruistic love, which is for the person's sake themselves. It's not for what you get out of that person, but rather for who actually they are, what the substance of that person is. Rav Dessler famously said that, you know, he asked somebody, what do you like? He says, I love fish. He says, you don't love fish. If you love fish, you'd let them swim in the water. You love yourself. And that's why you eat fish, because you're serving yourself, you love yourself. But real love is when you're altruistic, and it's not about you. It's about the other person. So Yaakov was able to achieve that real love of a substance, substantial love with Rachel. And he knew that Rachel would be the one with whom he would build Klal Yisrael. Rachel would be the one who was his soulmate. And together they would continue this incredible legacy of Avraham Avinu and Sarah Imenu and of Rivka and Yitzchak, who were his parents. And together they would build the Yud Beit Shvatim, the 12 tribes of Israel. And they would bring holiness and godliness. And as we mentioned at the beginning, the mission of the Jewish people into this world, into this physical world. So that was an altruistic real love. Once Yaakov was engaged in that real altruistic spiritual love, which had a value and had substance, then it went fast. Then it didn't seem like the days were, the clock was crawling and he'd never get there. That meant that the days went quickly. Because when we evolve in spiritual pursuits, when we're connecting on a spiritual level, when there's real substance in our life, it's not that we're filling this empty void, but rather we're living a life of meaning and purpose. So that's full and that's whole and that moves quickly. Stay with us. We'll be back in a moment.
You're listening to Adventures in Jewish History with Rabbi Danny Sachstein.
We're discussing that when we're involved in spiritual pursuits, so we have a sense of fulfillment and of tranquility, what we call in Hebrew, menuchas ha-nefesh. And when we don't have any spiritual aspect to our being, we're not connecting to the soul that's within us, and we are only engaged in a physical, material sense. We're only operating on the superficial, material, physical plane. So then we're constantly chasing our tails. Then we're constantly looking to fill that emptiness and that void. And only with a spiritual part of our being do we fill our lives up with substance and do we achieve a level of tranquility. And that we learn from Yaakov Avinu, that the Torah tells us that they were kiyamim achadim, that the days that he, 7 years that he worked for Rachel, were like single days. They went very quickly, because he loved her. Since he had an altruistic love for her, and he saw it wasn't a love based on what he's going to get from the relationship and based on how he's going to fulfill himself, it was a love because he saw the greatness of her, and together they would fulfill their divine mission. So that was something that went very quickly, it wasn't a excruciating wait, like, when are we going to get there? When is this going to happen? I think it's such a powerful lesson, certainly in today's modern times in our society. Because in our world today, we are all chasing our tails. We are running fast. The technology has not made things more quiet and simple, but it's only made the pace of life much faster. And we move at a very high speed all the time. And most of the time, we're trying to fill that emptiness and that void. Most of the time, we're chasing after the next desire, and we're trying to fill up that which is empty inside. And that's why we see so much addiction in our world today. That's why we see so many marriages breaking up and so many people that are depressed and that are sad and that are lonely, because our world, our lives are not filled with substance and with real significant spiritual accomplishments. if we're able to connect on a spiritual level, if we're able to, as Jews, we're very fortunate to have a Torah. The Torah tells us what God wants of us. The Torah gives us a framework of how to work and grow and what to do and how to overcome our lower side, our animalistic side, and access our higher self, our spiritual self. If we're able to do that, so then suddenly there's a transformation which will surprise everybody, which is absolutely staggering, because suddenly our life is now filled with meaning and with purpose and with substance, and we feel a sense of tranquility and a sense of fulfillment. And that's an amazing thing. I was privileged to learn in Israel for many years, and I noticed in Israel an interesting phenomenon, and that was that I was around people that we all know that materially things are difficult to come by in Israel, and people struggle, and most people live in very small apartments. There's a high concentration of population in small areas, and people seem to get by with much less. And in the environment, the circles I was in, where I was privileged to learn in yeshivas, in religious environments, the people seemed to me to be very happy. People seemed to be fulfilled. Their lives were filled with light. They were comfortable and satisfied and happy with themselves, and they were happy in the relationships they were in and with those around them. They seemed to be living a life that was quite fulfilling. And here in South Africa, I noticed that although we're blessed with an abundance of material bounty, of material success, but the contrast was quite clear that people were not as fulfilled and as satisfied with themselves and with their lives, and people were agitated and were running and were searching and were anxiously seeking the next pleasure. And even though they had great physical comfort and material wealth, they were still looking for that satisfaction in life, that menuchas hanefesh, that fulfillment and meaning. And the answer is exactly what we're saying, is what we see in Yaakov Avinu. When we are connected to something spiritual, so we're able to fill up ourselves. But when it's only, when we're only operating on the physical plane, so it's a bottomless pit. It's the vessel's got a hole in the bottom. Everything falls out. There's nothing that we hold. We don't hold anything of substance in our world. And that's something that's a very powerful teaching. The Mishnah in Pirkei Avos tells us the same thing. Mishnah in Pirkei Avos says, "Pas be melach toicho, mai mashur tishte al aretz tishan ashrech v'tovlach." It says that if you eat bread and water, and you have a measured amount of water, and sleep on the ground, so ashrech v'tovlach, that's good for you. So obviously, you know, we need to understand it in our times. It doesn't mean that we're on a level, not on a level that we can totally disconnect from the physical world, and we all have basic physical needs. But if the focus of our life is spirituality, and if we're working for something bigger and something greater and something beyond ourselves, not just chasing our next desire and am I going to fulfill myself and get and be, you know, and achieve the next pleasure, so then that's when we have a sense of accomplishment and satisfaction and fulfillment in life. And although these madregas, these levels of the avos and imas, of the matriarchs and patriarchs, are beyond our capacity to achieve, because they were spiritual giants, they were powerhouses. But nonetheless, we learn the principles and we see the direction in which we should go, and we should try and achieve, based on our level, whatever we can in these different areas. And so we learn from Yaakov that reaching out for something bigger and connecting to God and spirituality provides one with a fulfillment like nothing else will, nothing material will in our lives. And it gives us, and it moves quickly. We don't feel like we're waiting and longing and chasing all the time, but we actually feel a sense of tranquility and of satisfaction. And the same is true in marriage. That in a marriage, if we're not just in it for ourselves and seeking our own pleasure and our own gratification, but rather we see the other, we notice that somebody else exists outside of ourselves, we can try to the best of our ability provide for the needs of that other person. Well, that's the basis, that's the foundation of a successful relationship and a successful marriage. And if we're able to do that, if we're able to work in that area, so our spouse will sense that. Our spouse will sense either way, you know, the spouse knows straight away if we're just in it for ourselves and our own pleasure and our own gratification, or whether we're really in it for the other and we want to provide the needs of the other and look to the other and be there for them in whatever way we can. So that creates a security and a harmony and a foundation which is of mutual love and respect. And if we're able to do that, so then the marriage is bigger than the individual, and we're able to give up on our own personal petty needs in order to build the marriage in a big way. We do have needs, and we can't pretend that we don't. And of course, we have to be reasonable and sensible about it. But nonetheless, to strive to see the other and provide for the other is what the foundation of a marriage is. And unfortunately, that's why we see so much divorce, is because we're immature and we're selfish, and we're not able to rise above our own personal vested interests and needs, our own ego, and see the other and provide for the other. So this principle really applies to all aspects of our existence, of all aspects of our lives. And it's something that follows through in everything that we do. And it's no question, it's tried and tested, that when we connecting to a spiritual truth, we're able to fill our lives with substance and meaning, and break out of the shallow emptiness and loneliness of the material world. Stay with us. We'll be back shortly.
You're listening to Adventures in Jewish History with Rabbi Danny Sackstein.
So to close off, I thought we would, since this is Adventures in Jewish History, we would look at Hanukkah, which is not far away, from a historical perspective. We are now, and the date today is the 6th of Kislev, so we're only 2.5 weeks away from Hanukkah. Hanukkah, the first night of Hanukkah is Sunday night, the 2nd of December, so it's really creeping up on us, not far away at all. Hanukkah is a beautiful festival, a very powerful festival, and we should think about Hanukkah and prepare for Hanukkah in order that we can celebrate it the way we are supposed to. Hanukkah is a remembrance, a commemoration of events that happened in the year 323 before the Common Era. The great Alexander the Great, Alexander Mukdon, as he's known in the Gemara, Alexander of Macedonia, he conquered most of the civilized world in 1200 before the Common Era. And at a very young age, he was an incredible warrior, a great tactician in terms of battle, and he developed the first mercenary armies in the world, and he comfortably conquered most of the civilized world. When Alexander dies, and he dies as a result of wounds that he received in battle, the great empire needs to try and continue without him, and there was a lot of conflict over succession. And eventually, the empire split into two, the Northern Empire and the Southern Empire. And as time went on, the king of the Southern Empire was Ptolemy, and his capital was in Egypt. And the kings of the Northern Empire had their capital in Northern Europe. Israel usually was siding, the people in the land of Israel at the time were a part of or siding with the Southern Empire. But the king Antiochus the Third, he was quite an ambitious individual, and he decided that he wanted to conquer the Southern Empire. And he moved his forces south, obviously through the land of Israel, and conquered the Ptolemy Empire in the south, and he therefore controlled the whole region. When his son took over, Antiochus the Fourth, so he was a virulent anti-Semite, and he gave the Jews in Eretz Israel an ultimatum. Either they should convert to the Greek way of life, they should become Hellenists, Yevanim, they should become Misyavnim, we call them, the Jews that became Yevanim, became like the Greeks. And that would mean to embrace Greek culture and Greek philosophy and the Greek way of life, which would mean to discard all observance of Torah and mitzvahs, and to, it was a worship of the human form, worship of the human mind, that the existence of life in this world, in this physical world, was all that counted. There was nothing beyond the here and now. That was the Greek view of the world, which is very different to the view of the Jewish view. The Jewish view is this is a world in which we are here to work spiritually, to generate spiritual merits, to have self-control and overcome our physical drives and desires. And then we can perfect ourselves and enjoy that finished product of a perfected human being for eternity when we leave this world and enter into the next world. And so the life of Jews in the land of Israel became almost impossible, and the observance of the learning of Torah, the observance of mitzvahs, was prohibited by the punishment of death. And so to remain a Jew was no longer a possibility under the Greeks. And there were a number of Jews that decided to rebel. The leader of the Jewish rebellion was Matisyahu Kohen Gadol, Matisyahu the Kohen Gadol, and he and his sons, he had five sons. His sons were Yochanan, Yehuda, Yonasan, Shimon, and Eliezer. And together with his five sons, he staged a rebellion against the Greeks. It was guerrilla warfare for the first time. It was real guerrilla warfare. The Jews were obviously much weaker. We're not talking about trained soldiers and mercenaries, but rather we're talking about a bunch of rabbis. This was Matisyahu, the Kohen Gadol, and his sons. They weren't versed in war. They were not soldiers. And so they had to learn how to fight a guerrilla war, and they did so very successfully. And obviously the war was miraculous, was phenomenal, was unbelievable. And through God's help, they succeeded in becoming such a thorn in the side of the Greeks that the Greeks decided it would be less painful for them and less expensive for them to leave the land of Israel to the Jews and to evacuate the land. And so that was the great success of Matisyahu and his sons. And they were therefore able to get rid of the Greeks from the land of Israel. The Greeks not only prevented them from observing the Torah mitzvahs, but also plundered the Jewish people's wealth and assets. They violated the Jewish woman. They desecrated the Beis HaMikdash, the temple. They pretty much obliterated the Jewish people. And so by defeating them, the Jewish people were able to rebuild themselves, and they were able to rebuild the temple. In the year 323 before the Common Era, the Greeks left, and they reconsecrated the temple, and they lit the menorah. They found the oil, the menorah. There was only one jar of oil that survived. And in order to light oil in the menorah, it needed to be pure oil, and to be tahor and not tame. There are many laws with regards to that. And they found one jar that was tahor, that was pure, with the seal of Kohen Gadol. It took them 8 days, another 7 days to develop their own pure oil. And that jar, there was only enough oil to burn for one day, actually miraculously burned for 8 days. And so the sages instituted that in all future generations, we should light the menorah. The menorah should burn for 8 days, and remember these tremendous miracles that happened to the Jewish people over 2,000 years ago. Thank you so much for listening. Have a wonderful day.